It's a great honor today to have such a distinguished cast of people, and not least for this important conversation, which really is going to be centered on what Brexit means for all of us across the United Kingdom and even in the Republic, perhaps. On my first left here is Professor Alvin Jackson. Many of you may know him from his days at Queen's, is that right? And now a professor of history at Edinburgh University. In the middle, Fintan O'Toole, perhaps Ireland's most distinguished commentator, and who has been writing with extraordinary power and punch in The Observer on the Brexit issues. He might give us a bit of a perspective from south of the border. And last, Jonathan Powell, last but not least, certainly known to many of you here in Belfast, of course, formerly Chief of Staff to Tony Blair, much involved in the Good Friday Agreement, and now working in his own charity, Intermediate, which attempts to resolve conflicts around the world. And actually, modest though he is, Jonathan had a major part in ending what's about a 50 to 60-year-old civil war in Colombia. The deal was signed, I think, only last month, is that not? So I'm going to hand over to Professor Jackson and get him to kick this thing off. Thank you.
Many, many thanks for that very kind introduction. I think if I may say something just about the structure of this conversation by way of starting point, I think what we're proposing to do is to address some of those points that are chiefly in our mind on this question for about 5 minutes each, starting perhaps with Jonathan. So to begin with, we'll have, as I say, 10 or 15 minutes in total of individual contributions, just setting out some of the central issues as they occur to us. And then after that, we will have an extended conversation, which will then be thrown open to you for questioning. And the five or six areas of investigation I think that we're seeking to pursue are, why has Brexit happened in the first place? Is it really going to happen, given the complexities of the current political situation? And I know, and many of you will know from reading the press, that Jonathan has very clear views on this theme. How serious are the risks to Northern Ireland, given the extent to which the European Union and indeed international contexts were important in building peace in Northern Ireland? Is Scottish independence now much more likely than formerly? And lastly, we'll take a look at the future shape of the United Kingdom as it seems just at present. So I can ask Jonathan maybe to kick off with a few moments just on the points as they occur to him.
Yes, thank you. Well, to try and answer those questions briefly in 5 minutes or less, the reason it happened is that David Cameron decided to call a referendum to save himself from his backbenchers during the last parliament. He didn't really think through the consequences of calling a referendum midterm, which people may express their opinions about all sorts of other issues other than the one actually on the piece of paper. And the public were rather keen to give the elite a bloody nose, which they did. So it happened. I don't myself necessarily feel it was a vote against the EU rather than perhaps a vote on issues like migration and the way the elite had behaved. My own guess, and it may simply be wishful thinking, but having been most of my life in government and noticed that things don't always look the same 1 or 2 years after they happen, my guess is that we may not actually ever get to a Brexit or a full Brexit in which we leave the single market and leave the EU in full. And the reason I think that is that it's actually quite hard when you come to do the negotiation. As David Davis observed, I think it was yesterday or the day before, this is a hellishly difficult negotiation. I made a small film for Newsnight before the referendum vote in which I tried to play out the negotiation with a former Portuguese colleague who'd been a commissioner. He played the commission negotiator and I played the British negotiator. And when you come to sit at the table, there are two big problems for a British negotiator. One is tactical, and that is the 2 years required under Article 50 to complete the negotiation. This is not a negotiation that is capable of being resolved in the course of 2 years. But if it is not resolved in the course of 2 years, it requires it can be vetoed by any of the existing member states of the EU, and the negotiations could be halted, and we can immediately be put into WTO measures rather than having any special arrangement with the EU whatsoever. So there's a tactical problem in going in the negotiations that we need it to be fast, it won't be fast, and we have to rely on the charity of the others to give us what we wanted. The other problem is the trade-offs between the different models that are available to us. We can either be a Norway, still in the single market, still contributing to the budget, still having free movement of labour. Or if that's not acceptable, then we're going to have to be try and be Switzerland, but the Swiss offer is no longer on the table even from Switzerland and has been taken away, so we can't go down that route. We can be Canada, which has a free trade agreement with the EU, or almost has a free trade agreement with the EU after 7 years of negotiation. But that has very severe problems for us, particularly the exclusion of services, which are 80% of the British economy. Or we can go to WTO rules. Those are basically the options. Everyone talks about a special deal for Britain that's a mixture of those, but it's still going to be a mixture of those provisions, and they're not going to get a mixture that suits us and doesn't suit them. So this is going to be a long and difficult negotiation, and I suspect when people look at the real choice when it comes to Brexit rather than some theoretical choice, they may take a rather different attitude. So instead of a Brexit that involves no foreigners ever coming to our shore again, a Brexit that involves an extra 100 million for the NHS every day, a Brexit that involves all the things that were promised during the campaign, instead we face something that means that we are going to have a seriously depressed economy, that means we will still be having immigration to the United Kingdom, where we're still going to be paying out a lot of money, where farmers will not be getting subsidies they expected to get. When that real choice is faced, public opinion may take a very different attitude in 1 year or 2 years' time. And one of the important things to understand is that even after we've triggered Article 50, we still have the option of not leaving the EU. That doesn't force our hand into leaving the EU. An excellent article by Jean-Claude Pires, the former EU legal advisor for 30 years, a very brilliant man, points out that the only way Britain can leave the EU is if we request to leave the EU, even after Article 50 is triggered. So, for example, we could negotiate for 2 years, see we didn't like the outcome, and decide we didn't want to ask to leave. If we decide not to ask to leave, we don't leave. No one can make us do so. So I suggest that it may be possible for us to avoid that option. In terms of why we would change our minds, I think it is some of the practical questions that impact here in Northern Ireland, for example. It is asserted by the British government that there will not be a hard border between Northern Ireland and the South when Brexit happens. It seems to me that is simply an assertion, and no one has given us an explanation of how that could conceivably work in practice. If we leave the single market, as seems likely, we will have a different customs policy from the Republic of Ireland unless the Republic were to leave the EU itself. If we leave the single market and have no freedom, no free movement within the EU, we will have a different immigration policy from the Republic of Ireland. If there is a different immigration policy on one side of the border and a different commercial policy on one side of the border, you will have to have customs posts and you will have to have immigration posts. The only option, apart from having them along the border between North and South, is to have them between the island of Ireland as a whole and the rest of the United Kingdom, which may not appeal immediately to all unionist politicians. And in any case, would effectively mean that Northern Ireland remained in the EU and was governed under the policies that applied in the Republic of Ireland. I love the discussions that have been going on about the practical solutions for this, that we could have special lanes for HGVs that would be stuck to. And I wondered to myself what Slab Murphy thinks about this particular policy and how it's to be implemented in practice by him. So it seems to me when they come to wrestle with these problems instead of having to assert that things will happen in a certain way, when they come to have to look at practical examples, people may change their minds. Maybe I'm wrong, but we shall see.
Thank you. Fintan?
Good afternoon, everybody. It's really lovely to be here in this magnificent place, which of course has itself so many resonances in relation to this being one part of little corner of Northern Ireland that is forever Europe, you know. And in a sense, that's what I want to just address briefly. which is the position of Northern Ireland and the position of the island of Ireland post the Brexit vote. There's a very supercilious comment, which I'm sure you've all heard over and over again during the Troubles, and particularly during the peace process, which of course Jonathan was so importantly involved in, which was, you know, from 1066 and all that, the idea that whenever a solution to the Irish question was in sight, the Irish would always change the question. And it sort of contained a certain kind of English paternalism, I suppose, in relation to the Irish over there causing trouble. Well, we're now in a situation where the Irish had solved their English question, and the English have changed the question. You know, it is worth saying that both parts of Ireland, through the most extraordinary pain and at enormous personal cost to so many people, you know, who are still suffering from that legacy of violence, but through that process and through other processes, something extraordinary happened on this island over the last 15 years, which is Anglophobia is dead. You know, Queen Elizabeth could come to Dublin, to the city I live, and 200 people were out to protest her presence. 200 people. And everybody's looked at them as lunatics. That was inconceivable for almost all of Irish history. Obviously, things would have been different at different stages, but the notion that there was not an English problem for Ireland is an extraordinary development, and I think it's happened so slowly, and it's happened with such care, and has been constructed in you know, piece by piece over time, that we don't really fully appreciate it until you suddenly are faced with this extraordinarily reckless act of English nationalism saying, actually, we don't care about that. None of that actually matters at all. What's happened here, what's happened within this part of the United Kingdom, what's happened on this island, is of no concern to what's now the central political power in Britain, and particularly in England, which is a kind of English nationalism. And this has pretty profound consequences for us, because it's not just about all of the economic consequences, which Jonathan has spoken so eloquently about, which we'll talk about more. Of course, those economic consequences are central. But there's something even more basic than that, which is, what is the architecture of these islands? How do we relate to each other? And how, in particular, at a time when we seem to have found an equilibrium in these relationships, ways of working together, which are not just about high diplomacy or about the kind of, hugely important kind of negotiations that Jonathan was involved in, but are actually popular. This is actually about how people feel about each other, how people are behaving towards each other. There is a kind of settlement, and that settlement has been overturned. When I had to write about this today after the Brexit vote for the Irish Times, the image that was in my head was, I remember being at a drunken party a very long time ago in a hotel where somebody wandered off and thought they could do the trick of, you know, when you pull the tablecloth off the table and leave all the crockery on the table, and it's a trick you can do, but if you're a bit drunk, it doesn't work. And that's what happened, you know. This was kind of reckless behavior of people who did not know what they were doing. You know, there was no plan. There was no sense of what Brexit means, what its consequences are, how it's going to unfold. And lots of different arrangements have been upset in the course of that. And one of those, and I feel really quite angry about it, is this settlement on these islands, which is a historic settlement. It's a settlement of problems which have been with us for hundreds of years. And how do we deal with that? Is maybe one of the things we need to talk about, and I won't go on about it right now, but I would just like to suggest a basic principle, which is a principle of democracy and a principle of consent. The Belfast Agreement is a radical piece of political thinking, because it says that the fundamental principle that's involved when you wish to change the polity or the political structures in which people live is consent. People have a right to consent to major changes in how they're going to be governed. And if this applies to questions like a United Ireland, for example, which it crucially does and must, I would say it equally must apply to Northern Ireland being taken out of the European Union. The people of Northern Ireland have a right to consent to what happens to them in relation to this. And there is no evidence that that consent is available. There was a democratic vote. There was a referendum. And the referendum result was pretty clear in Northern Ireland. I imagine if the referendum were rerun in Northern Ireland, it would be even more emphatic, because I think a lot of people thought of it as a kind of a generalized two fingers to whoever you wanted without actually thinking about the consequences for Northern Ireland. I remember watching on Spotlight the night after the referendum result, a farmer from the border, a big beef farmer, saying, "It's all going to be fine because London is going to pay us all the subsidies." Well, good luck with that, you know? And it's all going to be fine because we're just sick of regulation. We just, you know, the reason I voted to leave was I'm fed up of regulations on my farm. Well, good luck with selling Northern Ireland beef. Buy our unregulated beef. You know, that's a really good advertising slogan. You know, a lot of the consequences at the simple level haven't been thought through, but the more profound consequences for what the nature of these relationships is have not been thought through at all. And I think it is the democratic duty of the Northern Ireland government and of the Southern governments to say, however this works out, the people of Northern Ireland have a sovereign right to consent or not consent to being inside or outside of the European Union. And that's where you start. Where you end up is a question that might take us quite a long time to try to unravel. But I think that has to be the starting point.
Let me say just a couple of words about Scotland in all of this, and let me say as well a few things in terms of historical perspective, if I may. So as you're aware, 62% or so of Scots voted for Remain. Support for the Union in Scotland remains apparently steady, however. Though I would qualify that by saying that a lot of these poll data and economic data have to be judged in the context of where we are just at present, which is, I think, a kind of phony war period. So I don't think unionists can place enormous faith in that apparently secure unionist polling evidence. On the other hand, the immediate prospects for Scottish independence are not hugely rosy either. The collapse of oil revenues underlines the economic challenges facing the current SNP government and indeed any push for independence. It's frequently forgotten. A few journalists picked this up, I think, in the aftermath of the referendum. It's frequently forgotten, nonetheless, that there is an old-style SNP tradition of Euroscepticism, which in fact fed into Brexiteering. So Nicola Sturgeon, amongst her many challenges, has to keep a weather eye upon the perhaps 30-35% of SNP voters who almost certainly voted Brexit. And that, I think, explains why she's at present making haste slowly, caught as she is between the heightened expectations of some of her followers and the need for continual momentum and the reality that the polling and economic figures don't look, in fact, all that good for her. Can I turn to history? Given that history is my day job, you would probably expect and fear that I would give you a history lecturette on this sunny Saturday afternoon, but it will be a lecturette rather than a full 50-minute lecture. As Fintan has said, the House here is important in terms of European politics, and those of us who listened to John Bew's eloquence this morning will have that firmly at the front of our minds in terms of the Congress of Vienna, for example, and the wonderful Congress of Vienna chairs that are one of the highlights of the collection in the House. But it's important, I think, for us here this afternoon to remember that this House has been at the centre of discussion, not just about the shape of Europe, but specifically about the shape of these islands and the interconnections between these islands, with Castlereagh, as John Bew was saying this morning, one of the architects of the Act of Union with the 6th Marquess of Londonderry and Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in the 1880s, and with his successors again at the centre of seeking to define relationships between these two islands. Frequent visitor to Mount Stuart in 1912-1914 was Edward Carson. Carson is frequently defined in kind of monodimensional terms as an uncomplicated unionist. Carson intellectually is quite interesting, and amongst the many, if you like, revisionist takes on the union that he seriously concerns is a federalist revision of the relationship between these two islands. I think a related point that I would make is that the Union throughout its 200-plus year history has been extraordinarily malleable, and given that the title of this session is Can the Kingdom Stay United After Brexit, it's probably worth bearing in mind that the Union has been cobbled together, redefined, patched up on many, many occasions in the course of the past two centuries. And that, I think, is actually quite an important perspective on where we are at present. Part of the history of this malleability has been the earnest discussion of reform of the Union, and one of the motifs of that reform conversation over the past 200 years has been an effort to strike a balance between separatism and unionism, and that balance frequently has taken the shape of various federalist initiatives from the 1840s, the 1870s, the period before the First World War, and indeed now, interestingly, from the likes of Gordon Brown and indeed others. There's growing interest in a federalist revision of the UK Constitution. I mentioned Gordon Brown, he's written on this theme. His key advisor, Jim Gallagher, formerly head of the devolution unit, I think at number 10 in Tony Blair's time, also very active in this regard. But there are others within Toryism, including the very prominent Scottish Tory journalist, David Torrance. There's a cross-party constitution reform group led by Lord Salisbury, but including people like Peter Hayne as well. I think it would be foolish to gloss over the severe challenges of any such approach, but in the context of an apparently awkward set of political problems, federation or a redefined and loosened federation might just create the space for more flexibility in terms of relationships, which might in turn permit different relationships between the constituent polities of these islands and the European Union. Now, I throw that out as a suggestion, not necessarily with any evangelical conviction, but just as an indication of the kind of possible answer to this question, can the kingdom stay united after Brexit? Okay. Those are our three pitches. I think now we move to take the different kind of constituents of the menu that I set out at the beginning of the session and try and work our way through those five or six points. And the first one was, why has it happened? And the question, I think, that has been in many people's minds, and indeed we discussed briefly over coffee in advance of this session, is how can a united kingdom government stumble into a constitutional turmoil of these dimensions without having done, so it would seem, due diligence of any shape or form? Now, as an historian working through the archives and looking at British governments dealing with Northern Ireland from the late 1960s onwards, one issue that continually strikes me is contingency planning and a succession of British governments, Labour and Conservative, demand of their civil servants, or in some cases those civil servants act independently anyway, and prepare a whole variety of fallout scenarios for their political masters. On this occasion, that doesn't seem to have happened. moreover, on this occasion, that deficit is all the more striking because it seemed to me that some contingency planning had been done, but it was by Mark Carney and not by Number 10 Downing Street. So maybe I can throw that at Jonathan for some illumination.
Well, as someone who was a civil servant for a good part of their life, yes. I think why it happened is the reason that I tried to explain at the beginning. What was won on the playing fields of Eton was lost on the playing fields of Eton. If you go back to the Congress of Vienna and the Battle of Waterloo, it was because of the people who were rash enough to dash into enemy guns and win things. Here we have someone who dashes into enemy guns in a negotiation without having thought through the consequences. And it really is almost as simple as that. Someone who entered into a referendum without thinking what the downside was and why he was taking this risk for anything other than purely partisan reasons. In terms of the civil service planning, Jeremy Hayward, the cabinet secretary, said something rather interesting last week in front of this week we just had, in front of the Public Affairs Select Committee, where he said that, yes, of course we did contingency planning, but since we had no idea what contingency we were looking at, we couldn't do any proper planning. By which he meant, I think, that the referendum was a vote against something, not a vote for something. It was a vote against immigration. It was a vote against what the banks had done. But it wasn't a vote for what our future was going to be outside of Europe. And so he couldn't plan for the Norwegian option, the WTO option, the Canadian option, and so on. It wouldn't have made much sense. Furthermore, I suspect that David Cameron would have given instructions to the civil service not to do overt planning for a defeat in the referendum, because that would concede that he would have suffered such a defeat. So he would not want the work to be done, to be leaked, to suggest, yes, there was a practical way forward. And if you think about it, the contingency planning certainly wasn't done by the Brexit camp themselves. They themselves have all come up with completely different answers about what Brexit means. And you've seen Theresa May slap them down as they announced them one by one. So Liam Fox says that we're going to leave the single market, he's slapped down. David Davis announces something else, he's slapped down. They don't really have a clear plan, and I don't think you can blame it on the civil service for the lack of contingency planning. But I want to take issue with one thing that Fintan said about the about English nationalism. I don't think this was a conscious act of English nationalism. This wasn't people with Cross of St George going out and voting for English nationalism. And even if they were, they certainly weren't thinking, I'm afraid about Ireland. And a good part of the history of the British government, let alone the British people, is that the main problem is not so much that they've thought about Ireland and come up with a plan, it's that they're not thinking about Ireland and not doing anything about it. If you look back to the 60s when the Home Office used to reply to letters about Northern Ireland saying, it's nothing to do with us. It's that kind of attitude, I'm afraid, and they hadn't thought through the consequences for Northern Ireland. That wasn't on their agenda, even though Tony Blair and John Major both came here to campaign pointing out the risks exactly for it. But I don't think it was English nationalism that won that vote.
Well, can I disagree with that? And well, partly agree and partly disagree with it. You're absolutely right that it's not, the English nationalism is not nationalism as we know it, you know, because nationalism historically, if you think about Irish nationalism, for example, whether you think it's good or bad, it articulates itself, right? So Irish nationalism, God knows, spent a very long time building up a rationale for itself, a sense of what its identity was, an entire hinterland of artistic and cultural, historical narratives, you know, economic theories. You know, you have a whole raft of things that goes into the making of a nationalism. I think English nationalism, I have no problem. The English are as entitled to be nationalistic as anybody else, so I'm not saying that English nationalism is itself inherently evil. My problem with the kind of English nationalism that's manifested itself in the referendum, and I think it does manifest itself, is that it's an incoherent and indeed in many ways inchoate nationalism. Uh-huh. It hasn't even thought itself through. So you had this bizarre process whereby you got this moment of national self-determination and self-assertion without any real sense of thinking through what that is. What is an English identity? What is an English identity in a multicultural society? What is an English identity when you extract it, or can you extract it, from the imperial and British identities into which it has been contained for the last 200 years or even longer? Nobody quite knows what it is, But the fact that nobody quite knows what it is doesn't mean it's not there. And of course it's there. It's there in racism. It's there in the anti-immigrant sentiment. I mean, this is us and them. It's the classic atavistic nationalism at work. It's there in exactly the absences that you were talking about, Jonathan. You know, the very fact that there was no discussion that I could see, and I tried to watch it very carefully, in the mainstream English debate about Brexit, about the consequences for the Union, about what happens in Scotland, what happens to Ireland, what happens to the peace process, what are these relationships? The basic answer was, we don't care. I mean, people like Boris Johnson and you know, Davis and all of these people who were kind of leading the Brexit debate simply didn't care. I don't know if you remember the big Wembley debate, which is one of the big set-piece moments. And there was a moment where one of the speakers, Francis O'Grady, who is the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress, who is of Irish heritage, very gingerly raised the question of Ireland, and of Northern Ireland in particular. And it was almost as if she had started talking about Latvia or something. You know, what was the consequences of Brexit for Latvia? It was like, who cares? You know, why are you raising this obscure issue? This is about England. It's about English self-assertion. And what happens, you know, and just if you think about the fact that if you're prepared to risk the union with Scotland, which is the heart of the union, I mean, you know, then obvious, it's pretty obvious that Northern Ireland, to which England has a very ambivalent relationship anyway, is dispensable in this whole way of thinking. And so I'm not saying that it's an English nationalism in the sense that we could equate with Scottish nationalism or with Irish nationalism historically, but it is a nationalism and it is there. And it's a very difficult nationalism to deal with precisely because it is so ill-formed and under-articulated. But it is absolutely there. And I think there's been a historic mistake in the Union, which is the failure to actually give legitimate democratic expression to English nationalism. You know, I think if when there were devolution settlements, when the Scottish Parliament became a powerful institution, if at that point there had been, and I know there was a great deal of discussion of it, about how do you give England, how do you solve the English question, how do you give England a kind of democratic expression of its own identity? It's perfectly legitimate. There's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't have to be on the ultra-right. It doesn't have to be xenophobic or racist. There are fantastic English traditions of democracy, of social justice, of connection with the world, of which, if I were English, I would be enormously proud, and enormously proud to hold up a flag and say, this is what this represents. But I think the failure to do that has meant that you have this sleeping beast of an English nationalism, which has now been aroused. And where I disagree with Jonathan's optimism about the fact that Brexit ultimately won't happen, maybe it's because I'm Irish, but we know on this island that when you raise those forces, they're irrational forces, and they are very, very, very difficult to put back in the box. And I do not think... I mean, I think Jonathan, at a rational level, is absolutely right. I mean, once you start looking at the details of Brexit, you're going to turn around and say, this isn't kind of what we thought we were voting for. But I also don't think that any... There's no force in British politics which has the power or the authority to say that, to turn around and say, we got it wrong, and I'm showing good leadership here. I'm telling you, you have to rethink this. The Labour Party, unfortunately, from my point of view, is imploding. The Liberal Democrats are a very marginal force. So you would have to look, practically speaking, over the next 2 years for a force within the Tory party which is going to turn around and say, actually, we have to really fundamentally rethink this. And for those of you who know Irish history, somebody's going to have to be Michael Collins. Who's going to be Michael Collins in the English Tory party and say, you know, all this rhetoric that we had, all of this hope, well, you still have to compromise. You can't get what you thought you were going to get. Just as Collins had to go to London and had to come back and say, you know, all of the stuff we thought we promised ourselves, it's just not achievable. There has to be a compromise. There has to be something else. But, and you get shot. And I don't think Theresa May is going to be Michael Collins.
But I wonder if this take is not open to the obvious accusation that, understandably enough, we who are anchored for most of the time on the island of Ireland are essentially judging a distinctive English set of problems and issues. Well, we're in danger of judging them through an Irish lens and looking at this English thwarted identity through the lens of the variety of national identities on this island, and in particular through the lens of Irish nationalism, and through applying historical analogies like Michael Collins and Bíonn na Blá to a particular English situation where the fit is not really exact, and we might come, therefore, to skewed conclusions. The accusation might be that if you put too much emphasis on nationalism, you're discounting other factors that fed into this vote, like the instinctive desire to give a distant and maybe to some extent discredited political classes a good kicking, the sense in which Brexit was also about at some level, perhaps social inequality within Great Britain and an economic protest vote. So that simply by labelling it English nationalism is perfectly understandable from an Irish perspective, but doesn't...
But all of those factors, you're absolutely right. It is about social inequality. It is about reactions to globalisation. It is about reactions to the sense that we don't control anything anymore. But when is nationalism not that? Whose nationalism isn't about that? Mm. You know, nationalism, of course, is it's a structure which gives you a sense that there is a narrative and an identity to which you can aspire, which will be a solution to precisely all of those questions. Nationalism is never abstract. Irish nationalism was never abstract. Scottish nationalism was never abstract. You know, it's always contingent on specific economic and social conditions at the time. I don't need to tell you this as a great historian. So I'm not arguing that there's this direct and simple analogy between English nationalism and Irish nationalism. What I am saying is that English nationalism has found itself in the driving seat before it has even reached the point of being a coherent nationalist movement. And this is its problem. So it's there, it has roused all of these forces. And it's once you do it, so once you say, we have now transformed our future with that kind of great rhetoric that nationalism brings, there's always then the hangover. You know, you always wake up and say, oh, our future isn't transformed. Why not? You know, we had the 1916 rising and we still have all these problems. We had our UK Independence Day when we voted for Brexit and we still have all these problems. What happens then is that some people start to say, well, okay, we've got to back out of this. We've got to back away from this rhetoric. We've got to back away from this great single moment of national transcendence and try to be rational about it. And other people say, no, that is betrayal. That is treason. And what's entered into the English national discourse now is a discourse of betrayal. Because you've had this moment. It may be a completely insane moment, and it is from my point of view, but it is a moment of national self-determination. And getting away from that, I think, is really, really difficult. I think it's desirable, but I just think we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which those national passions have been aroused and to which the accusation of being the traitor who has sold out the expressed desires of the English people will become an important factor in how this will play out.
I sense we're getting back to Michael Collins here. Jonathan, did you want to come in?
Yeah, it doesn't really feel like that in Britain. I don't think people even think of it about English people voting against Ireland or Scotland or anything else. I think it is a rather different sort of protest. And betrayal has long been a theme of British politics. It hasn't been invented by this. Tony Blair was betraying Labour values and so on. So that's not new. I can think of three ways in which this could be reversed. The first is if you had a pro-European leader of the Labour Party or some other party that filled the gap that currently exists in British politics. There are a very large number of people now unrepresented in Westminster. If we're going to have a Labour Party that is anti-European, Tory party that is largely anti-European and Lib Dems who scarcely exist, someone needs to be there to speak up for pro-European, socially liberal, economically conservative or economically liberal policies. At the moment that doesn't exist, but either the Labour Party will get a leader that represents that or there will be a new party that represents that view. So you could have someone running in an election, for example, wanting to reverse what had happened, and that could change things. The other thing is, I think it's worth watching what Mrs. May is doing quite carefully. She is positioning herself. She can't be the person who betrays the vote because she herself was a Remainer. She's appointed three idiots to try and handle the negotiations so that if and when it goes wrong, she can blame it on them. They had this great idea of Brexit. Why have they not managed to deliver it? She chooses her words very carefully. If you listen to her on Andy Marr 2 weekends ago, she didn't say we had to get rid of free movement. She said we had to change free movement. And that's my third way, which is the EU itself is not some static actor in all of this. It is quite possible for the EU, if it chooses to do so, to come up with options that may be attractive to the United Kingdom. They have many problems themselves with immigration issues. It's often very different immigration issues. One could conceive of a deal that was done for Mrs. Merkel to get her off the hook on her migration issues that also solved the British problem on migration, which I think is the main motive factor behind the vote. So this wouldn't necessarily be betrayal at all. It may be what Boris Johnson talked about at the beginning of all of this, where he said what we should have is vote against the Cameron deal, have a new negotiation, and then have a vote on a new deal, exactly what Ireland has done twice before. And that might well provide us with a way out.
Maybe I can voice a thought and pitch it at you, Jonathan. I was at a conference lately where I think it was John Denham talked about what he saw as the agnosticism, was the phrase he used, the agnosticism of the English towards the Union, by which he meant the Scottish Union as well as the vestigial Union connection between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Does that ring true to you, given your place at one time at the heart of government?
I think abstract ideas like this are very low down on in the priorities of English voters. When you look at, and that includes the European Union, not just the Union of Scotland, the Union of Northern Ireland, the issues in my political lifetime, the first two issues on British voters' minds have always been the economy and migration. And they go up and down depending on the state of the economy. If the economy is doing badly, the economy becomes the first issue and migration becomes the second issue. Otherwise, if the economy is doing okay, then migration becomes the top issue. It's been the case for the last 30-odd years. And I think those will always be the top issues. And they, as far as they're concerned, issues to do with the EU used to be about number 10 on the list of issues, salient issues to British voters. And I suspect that you'd find that Scottish independence comes even lower down than that, let alone Northern Ireland, which would come below that too. So I just don't think it's very much on their mind. And since no one's going to ask them ever to vote on the issue, it's never going to become apparent what they do think.
Well, what about mindsets in central government? Because again, this maybe takes us back to the starting point of our conversation, just about what seems like an extraordinary set of political risks over Brexit relating to the constitutional stability of Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom more widely. That suggests that there is no long-term strategic perspective about the unions of these islands.
Well, there certainly wasn't in going into the referendum, personally by those proposing Brexit. Because on the whole, it's the little Englanders of UKIP who have just voted for something that's going to bring about, as we've just discussed, the disappearance of the United Kingdom. I mean, I know we're not supposed to talk about Scotland until later, but just picking up your point on Scotland, it does seem to me at least probable that if the British government decides to leave the single market, the Scottish government will demand a referendum, regardless of the oil price. Yeah. It seems quite likely to me that the Scottish population in those circumstances would vote to leave. Mm. You would then lose Scotland from the Union and present Northern Ireland with a really chronic problem, because then you'd not only have the problem of a hard border with the South, you'd then face the problem of a hard border with Scotland as well. Mm. And Northern Ireland would find itself floating as a little island in the middle of the North Atlantic, with the trade routes normally going through Stranraer blocked to it, with its traditional relationship with Scotland rather than England. And what Northern Ireland politics would come like then in the context of being an island surrounded by the EU, it's very hard to imagine.
I certainly agree that from London's perspective, as I think I indicated, the current polling data on the Union are likely to give a very false impression indeed, because these data refer to what I've described as a phony war where nothing much in terms of the advancement of Brexit has happened. And when that advance takes place, I would not be at all surprised if that polling data on the union shifted. Well, maybe taking your point, can we shift and think about Northern Ireland and the, you know, Fintan addressed this a little bit and maybe try to get our heads around how serious the challenge of Brexit for Northern Ireland is. And maybe I can throw that to you, Fintan, sure, because that clearly has been at the centre of your concerns lately.
Yeah. Look, there are two ways of looking at it. I mean, the DUP, which, of course, campaigned very strongly for Brexit, is saying it's all going to be fine. You know, there really is no fundamental problem. And I'm sure that's a very sincere view. It seems to me to be utter denial. And I think the reason it's utter denial is it's based on an entirely disconnected view of the Republic of Ireland and of the South and what's going to happen. Let me just explain what I mean by this. So we keep being told there will be no hard border. You have nothing to worry about. So basically this seismic change in the constitutional arrangements on these islands is not going to affect what happens on this island itself. And we've got sort of reassurance after reassurance from the Secretary of State, from Theresa May, from pretty much everybody who has spoken about it, that don't worry about it. The common travel area will remain. There will not be a customs border. There will not be a migration border. And then you say, how is that going to be the case? Well, we're not going to give you a running commentary on Brexit, so come back to us in 3 years' time. And it seems to me to be fundamentally dishonest, because there's only one way in which it can be the case. If you follow it through logically, there's only one way you will not have a hard border, and that is, well, of course, this is assuming Brexit goes ahead, so if we leave aside Jonathan's scenario about it not happening, assuming it happens, there's only one way in which there will not be a hard border, and that is if the Republic of Ireland also leaves the European Union. And when you hear most, certainly DUP people and a lot of Tories talking about this, that's what they think is going to happen. The logic of their position, and it's quite explicit. In the Irish Times this morning, Ian Paisley Jr. says it's not going to be a problem because the Republic of Ireland is going to be out of the European Union by 2020. And I've had conversations with people like John Taylor, for example, who have said exactly the same thing. And it's an extraordinarily ignorant view of where the Republic of Ireland is historically and what's happened to the Republic of Ireland. It's based on a simple kind of historical correlative, which is the Republic of Ireland joined the European Union in 1973 because Britain did. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. The state of the Republic of Ireland in 1973, when 66% of its entire trade was with Great Britain, meant that regardless of any other consideration, if Britain was joining the European Union, it had to join the European Union. However, it's kind of important in Northern Ireland to notice that the Republic of Ireland now is not quite the same as it was in 1973. I mean, you know, quite a lot of things have happened in the meantime. And one of them is the integration of the Republic of Ireland into the global economy, for good and ill. The Republic of Ireland's economy there's a rank of economic globalization that's produced every year by Foreign Policy magazine, and the Republic of Ireland is usually either first, second, or third, you know, with places like Singapore and Hong Kong in terms of integration into the global economy. It is fantasy to think that there are circumstances in which the Republic of Ireland is going to simply leave the European Union because the UK is leaving the European Union. It's not going to happen. And we need to get over that first, because that's the block, that's the mental block, and that's the thing that's kind of allowing them to say it's all going to be fine. So assuming that the Republic of Ireland is not going to leave the European Union, you then have what seems to me to be an act of extraordinary aggression. And I don't want to be overly rhetorical about this, although I quite enjoy being overly rhetorical, but you know, it's an extremely aggressive thing to do to the people of this island, to not just reimpose a border, because it's not that. It's actually imposing a much, much more significant and tighter border than we have ever had before. So it's not going back to the old border. The old border was a customs border. We all enjoyed it greatly. I remember coming up on the train to Belfast weighing 6 stone as a child and going back weighing 12 stone because you bought your clothes and you put them all on, you know. So, and it was a great joke. I mean, because, you know, the whole customs border was a joke. You know, you bought butter and sweets and things, and clothes were cheap. And presumably there was some vice versa. It's not going to be like that. I mean, if Brexit means Brexit, as we're continually told, it has to also be a migration border. Uh-huh. And a migration border is a very serious business. And it's a very serious business, not just, one of the extraordinary things here is that it's spoken about as if there's only one player in this, which is post-Brexit Britain. It's also going to be a European Union border. The European Union is going to control its borders. And one of those borders is going to run through this island. It seems to me that that is intolerable and cannot be allowed to happen. And this brings us back to the issue of consent. It seems to me that Northern Ireland is actually in quite a strong position if it has a coherent and strong voice. There is enormous sympathy throughout the European Union for the idea that Northern Ireland has suffered hugely, has overcome that suffering, that the peace process and what happened to it is of global significance, that it is one of the achievements of the European Union itself to have contributed to that. And there's a very eloquent and very strong argument to be made, which I think will be received very well by most of the major European governments, that Northern Ireland is a special place. It is a special place. I mean, the idea that you can simply say, well, there was a vote in the United Kingdom, and it's just as if Sussex had voted to remain and the rest of the United Kingdom voted to leave, and therefore tough. Northern Ireland, by international treaty, registered with the United Nations, is a polity. It's a different place with different constitutional arrangements, with its own sovereignty. Northern Ireland's sovereignty was established in two different ways in the Belfast Agreement. It was established by the very fact that there was a referendum. The Belfast Agreement was passed by referendum of the people of Northern Ireland. And within that agreement itself, it is absolutely clear that the people of Northern Ireland are sovereign in determining their future. What kind of polity is Northern Ireland is up to the people of Northern Ireland. This is radical, it's extraordinarily progressive, interesting thinking, but it's there and it cannot be undone. This is an international treaty. It takes precedence over an advisory referendum in the United Kingdom. And, you know, this may be a combative thing to say, but it's absolutely true in legal terms. So there needs to be, it seems to me, an absolutely clear statement from the Northern Ireland Assembly and from the Northern Ireland government that however this plays out, the people of Northern Ireland are sovereign in relation to this. And you have a sovereign interest in the maintenance of the peace process, in the maintenance of Northern Ireland's status as a place which has the right to determine its own destiny, and in the maintenance of an all-Ireland economy, which has been emerging and has been extremely positive to all of us. If you don't start from there, then Northern Ireland's interests are going to be entirely disregarded in this whole process because they were entirely disregarded in the debate about Brexit itself.
I can see clearly the desirability, from my point of view, of the position that you're arguing. I can see clearly the persuasiveness of that case, that Northern Ireland is a special place, that the Good Friday Agreement has been vested with the United Nations, as you describe, endorsed in referenda preceding June. On the other hand, if I were a Spanish minister looking at Catalonia and looking at the possibility of special deals being cut with individual polities inside member states of the European Union or outgoing member states of the European Union, I would be somewhat suspicious, I think, of the case that you're arguing, I think. Or even if I were with a leap of imagination, Nicola Sturgeon sitting in Edinburgh looking at a special set of arrangements being cut to Stormont in the way that you described, I think I might be skeptical. So I think my suggestion is that despite the force of your argument, there is likely to be opposition.
You're absolutely right, of course, there will be opposition, but and I don't want to be crude about this, but Northern Ireland has a very eloquent and powerful argument, which is the Troubles. You know, Catalonia does not have blood in this game. Northern Ireland does. I think there is an appreciation of that, and I think Jonathan probably knows this even more powerfully than I would. But you know, I don't think the analogy between Catalonia and Northern Ireland is necessarily a persuasive one when you if you want to talk to Angela Merkel about it, if you want to talk to the Italians about it, if you want to talk to the French about it. I think there is an understanding that there's something different happens here.
Jonathan. I mean, Fintan is clearly right in saying that the assertion by the government that there isn't going to be a hard border simply isn't good enough. One of the favourite arguments for me that they throw up is, well, we had a common travel area before we joined the EU, so obviously we'll have one after. But that's because we had a common policy on migration before we joined the EU, and we will not have one if we leave the single market. We will have one immigration policy, the Republic of Ireland will have another. So you'll have to have a hard border. And the hard border will have political consequences for the peace process. It will not send us back to the Troubles. It will not actually increase the desire for a border poll, I don't think. And what it does is it destabilizes the whole basis on which the Good Friday Agreement was built, which is to allow people to have their own identity. They could live in Northern Ireland and be Irish, or they could live in Northern Ireland and be British. They could do whichever they wanted. And this reopens that whole question, because if you put a hard border back in, and it will have to be a border with the small roads blocked off again, it will have to be a border with border posts along the way, not just people driving through. It's going to be a undermine that whole understanding and reopen the question. There are only two ways in which it can be done effectively. The one that Fintan described, which is the belief of someone like Ian Paisley Jr. that somehow Ireland is going to leave the EU and join the UK in Euroscepticism and have the same policies as us. Or alternatively, it could be that Northern Ireland leaves the UK effectively and becomes part of the EU with the Republic of Ireland. And I do remember Ian Paisley Sr. coming into Number 10 during the foot and mouth crisis and hammering the table and saying, our people may be British, but our cows are Irish. Because he wanted the cows to be able to go backwards and forwards across the border. So there is a certain amount of flexibility in the DUP position. Maybe they could settle on the hard border, not between being between Ireland, North and South, but between the rest of the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland. I don't really think, personally, consent is the issue here, because if it was consent for Northern Ireland, then it would have to be consent for London. London voted very strongly for Remain. And Scotland did, of course, too. So if the British government conceded that consent applied to Northern Ireland, I think they would have to say that consent applied at least to Scotland as well. I do, however, think there is a way of addressing this question, and I think that the Scottish government is onto it to a certain extent, and that is that Mrs. May has said that the Scottish government will be consulted in terms of the negotiation. I think, actually, if I were the Scottish government or I were in the Northern Irish administration, I would insist that I was represented at the table in the negotiations. It's no good David Davis having a secret negotiation in which we are not part, and nor is it any good Mr. Brokenshire representing us. Mr. Brokenshire hasn't been elected to anything in Northern Ireland.
No.
But I would have thought the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister should insist on being represented at the negotiations and at the table at all times, and indeed the Scottish government should do the same. And that would certainly reinforce the chances of my prediction of not having Brexit substantially.
Just as a quick historical footnote in terms of the hard border between the island of Britain and the island of Ireland, there was a hard border of sorts during the war, actually, as a kind of precedent, admittedly a shaky precedent for that.
Mm-hmm. Didn't it continue for a period after the war?
I think it did, until the later 1940s, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. I'm conscious of time, and I'm also conscious that there will be people in the audience who will like an opportunity to put some questions to the panel. So do we have microphones And maybe I've also been warned quite severely that we have to end in just under 10 minutes. So are there any questions, please, at this stage for panelists? Yes. Maybe could you just... No, there's a question here, please, this first.
Mainly for Jonathan, if I can ask, when the Brexit was being talked about before the vote was implemented, do you think Northern Ireland would have been considered? And in light of what has happened, could Northern Ireland as an economic state start to fail?
I don't think the position of Northern Ireland probably was very much on David Cameron's mind when he called a referendum. And it certainly, as Hinton described, wasn't on the mind of the Brexiteers at all. They weren't thinking about it. And indeed, that's been quite a large part of the problem of British history with Northern Ireland, that we haven't ever been thinking about it. And that's caused many of the problems rather than us having some devious policy which we're suspected of. In terms of going it alone, I doubt it. But there was an interesting point that we were talking about earlier about federalism. I mean, you could imagine some sort of different relationship between the parts of the United Kingdom as a result of the shake-up to avoid the actual collapse of the United Kingdom. You could have a different sort of government in Northern Ireland. You could have it within the single market, for example, within the island of Ireland, but still being part of the United Kingdom. That's not impossible to imagine.
Over here, please.
Hi, really, for Fintan, you spoke quite a bit about English nationalism. But I wonder to what extent it really is English, because we have to consider the size of the minority here and in Scotland who voted as Brexiteers. But is there some such thing as UK nationalism then?
it's a very good question indeed. And of course, we also have to remember the Welsh who voted in the majority to leave. So I'm not saying English nationalism is the only force at work here. And I think you're absolutely right. There is a British identity which has historically always had a kind of anti-European focus. You know, it's seen itself as being good British beef against, you know, effete French ways and all that stuff. And of course, a religious factor historically, Protestant Britishness against sort of against Catholic Europe, all of those kinds of things are in the ether somewhere. I think it's a really very valid point you raise. It's much more complicated than that. I was simply saying that, however, within that, I think there is an identifiable English nationalism. And I think the key push for this, after all, came from largely from English representatives within the Tory party. The reason that David Cameron took this fatal decision was because of the pressure he was under. And I think if you look at people like Michael Gove and Davis and even Boris was playing on this, you know, it is an English nationalism, it seems to me. As I said, it's not coherent. So it mixes itself up with a British nationalism, with an imperial nostalgia, with lots of other things, you know, but I think it is there. One brief point, just to make this, and I'll just make it very briefly, in terms of process and in terms of Northern Ireland, something that's forgotten about because it hasn't been articulated by the southern governments yet, but you have to remember, the southern government has a veto at any settlement. It hasn't said that because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't want to be aggressive about this right now. But as a full member of the European Union, the Dublin government can veto any settlement, and I think this is where it's going to get very interesting, and this is where Northern Ireland's interests. And this is not an Irish nationalist point, but Northern Ireland's interests are also very much in keeping open a relationship with Dublin in terms of the final settlements, because there is a sovereign government at the table which can have Northern Ireland's interests at heart, because in this, the interests of Northern Ireland and the interests of the Republic are absolutely the same.
Question here.
Give some thoughts to what the future of the European Union is itself. I mean, you could argue that Brexit was actually just a symptom of something that's much more global. We've seen, well, you can see what's happening in America. You know, there are very, very similar things that are happening right across the world. So the question about what will be the future of the Union itself, is this the beginning of the end for the Union? Because we focus a lot on what's happening to us at the moment, but I think it's a much bigger issue.
Yeah.
Well, certainly the feedback from the Bratislava conference and what Angela Merkel was suggesting at that conference doesn't suggest any profound optimism just at present. I also wonder whether the DUP perspective, the apparently skewed DUP perspective on Irish exit from the European Union, while as a freestanding point looking extremely strange, is in fact to be related to the wider kind of Brexiteer conviction that the European Union is disassembling anyway, and this current vote is only one stage in a wider process.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me if you were to be optimistic about Brexit not—it's not so much Brexit not happening, but Brexit not mattering for those actually worse reasons, which is the European Union itself collapses. And I think that's an absolutely real possibility. And it's a real possibility for all the reasons you were talking about. There is this kind of reaction against globalization. There's a reaction against the way that the social Europe, the social guarantees that were at the heart of the European project have been stripped away, and people are rightly reacting against that. We're seeing it in things like the Apple judgments, for example, you know, the resentment against the power of these multinational corporations. But we're also seeing it, I mean, what seems to me the most credible threat to the European Union is still the euro. The euro project is a failed project. It's not a big issue for you in Northern Ireland, but we've experienced it very, very sharply in the south. And it seems to me there is no plan for either getting out of the euro, of undoing that project, or taking it forward into the kind of arrangements that might make it work. So there is an existential crisis in the European Union itself. Perhaps all of our discussions will be made entirely irrelevant because there will be no European Union to Brexit from. If I had to bet, I would say the European Union has an interesting history of muddling through and of recreating itself. But the danger is that they will retreat, that they will see Brexit as just the stupid Brits have made this ridiculous decision and, you know, good riddance, rather than saying this is a wake-up call for the European project. And I think it's finely balanced at the moment in terms of that debate within Europe itself. If it's not seen as a wake-up call, if it does not lead to very radical democratic reform of the European Union itself, then the existential threat is very real, I think.
I must say, I disagree. I think that it's very... I see no likelihood of the EU breaking up. I think I spend most of my time in the rest of the world now. What I see is regional groups forming and coming closer. The whole... gravity is moving entirely the other way, and I think that will apply to Europe as well. I think if you look at what Michael Fallon said today, you see that what's going to happen to Europe, they're going to propose a European army. He says we're going to veto it until we leave. What they're going to do is move towards greater integration in a way that the UK has prevented them from doing up to now. And in particular, I fear that it will become less liberal in terms of its economic policies and become more protectionist. In particular, I think they will try and solve their euro problem. The euro problem always was that they didn't have the political aspect of the euro to go with the economic aspect. So they had a common currency union. They didn't have the political means of backing that up with transfers. They will move now in that direction because the EU will become contiguous eventually with the euro. So I actually think, on the contrary, what people warned about would happen when Britain leaves the EU is exactly what is going to happen. It will become less liberal. It will become more integrated, but it won't collapse.
One last question, please, just here.
Thank you. Somebody once said, Ireland's a small island entirely surrounded by politicians.
And lawyers.
I was wanting to ask Fintan particularly about what democracy means in Northern Ireland. With the Brexit thing, England and Wales had a reasonable majority, and fair enough if they want to leave. Scotland had a much larger majority to stay, and they seem to be inexorably moving towards a second independence referendum. Northern Ireland, yet again, seems to be in a unique position in that, ironically, the main party campaigning for Brexit has the word democratic in its very title. And as soon as the result was announced, their leader came out and hailed it as a wonderful result for democracy, and they'd be proceeding with all haste to make sure Brexit was carried out. If you look back to the late decades of last century, any straw polls that were taken were the United Kingdom people, not the politicians, the people, would have cut Northern Ireland adrift at a moment's notice when their soldiers were dying on the street and their cities would get blown up, and they were subsidising us to billions of pounds every year. Whereas Ireland insisted that the democracy of the United Kingdom had to prevail in Northern Ireland, even though the people of Northern Ireland didn't want to leave.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I disagree with Jonathan on this. I don't think there's a parallel between the Northern Ireland situation and London, for example, you know, where you could turn around and say, well, the people of London voted not to leave the EU, therefore that's parallel to the Northern Ireland situation. There is no parallel. I mean, Northern Ireland has effectively its own constitution. The Belfast Agreement puts in place a radically different constitutional arrangement than the one that prevails in London, for example, or in any other part of England. You can argue about Scotland, and there obviously are some parallels there. It seems to me that you have to start with democracy. You know, if you're in this very, very uncertain era where we don't know how all of this is going to play out, what the consequences are, you have to start by respecting the democratic choice of the majority of the people. And the democratic choice of the majority of people in Northern Ireland was actually very, very clear. You know, it's as emphatic as you're ever going to get in referendums. And it seems to me that this has to be respected. It has to be respected by the Northern Ireland government. It has to be respected by the UK government. It has to be respected by the Dublin government. The Dublin government has to see itself as a guarantor of the Belfast Agreement as having a responsibility to see that the democratic choice of the people of Northern Ireland is respected, and it has to be respected by the European Union. If the European Union is going to survive, it's going to survive on reigniting democratic values. I'm not as optimistic as Jonathan is that it's not in an existential crisis. Jean-Claude Juncker, who is the president of the European Commission, said on Friday, we have an existential crisis. I mean, you know, even at the top level, I think they're beginning to understand this. And the reason we're in an existential crisis is because, Jonathan's right, you either move forward with the euro, where you create all the political institutions of integration that would make the euro work, or you move backwards. But to move forward, that's what they want to do, but they do not have a democratic mandate to do this. You will not get greater European integration being supported by the French people, the Italian people, the Spanish people, the German people, I mean, never mind the Brits or the Irish, you know. So there's a democratic problem in the European Union. And the European Union has to go back to basics, and it has to start saying how we treat Brexit is going to be based on a respect for the democratic choices that were made. And Northern Ireland has a right to make a democratic choice. It chose to stay in the European Union. Is that easy? No, it's not. But we have to think about how we can best accommodate that and how we can best say this matters. And it matters not just to Northern Ireland, it matters to what kind of Europe we're actually trying to forge and how we reflect the democratic choices of people within the structures that we're creating.
Okay, I think we have to end at this point. Time is very much against us. I don't think we were ever going to solve this question in this particular afternoon session. Hopefully we've helped to elucidate it a little bit for you. Thank you very much for your attendance. Thank you to my fellow panelists.